Hey, Dr. Drew here, and this is just a reminder that the discussions here are not a substitute for medical care or medical evaluation. This is purely for entertainment and education. We hope you learn something, but see your doctor, get proper medical care. I want to mention our friends at Bergamot Sport, a supplement that provides all the cardiovascular benefits of the original Bergamot, but with additional additives designed to aid athletes and those with active lifestyles. Bergamot Sport is recommended and used by professional and college athletes throughout the world, helps them improve stamina, reduce recovery time, and muscle inflammation. Bergamot Sport is informed sport certified, so athletes can feel confident that it's all natural and it has been banned substance tested. But even if you're not a pro athlete or just getting a workout once a week or so, Bergamot Sport is still worth a try. It can help you work out harder, recover easier, without worrying about being sore or tired the next day. I've used the products myself. I've recommended them to patients. We use them in our family. And I've done so just as physicians and cardiologists around the world have done. And Bergamot Plus is excellent for what's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which has just passed all other forms of liver disease in terms of causing cirrhosis. So it's something that is a major health issue presently and needs to be paid attention to. For a limited time, our listeners can save 10% on their order by entering code DRDREW at checkout. That is DRDREW, all one word. Try Bergamot Sport for yourself. Visit bergamot.com, that is BERGAMET.com, or just click the Bergamot banner at drdrew.com. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the iPad, get Granny out of the spare bedroom, and come and listen to another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest.
Why Granny? Why is it always Granny?
Because it used to be for multi-generations,
bro.
You had your grandma living at home or grandpa, because grandpa usually dies earlier. We got some doctors here.
You have in your mind one of those wooden radios.
Everyone gets in the living room and joins together as a family and shares in something. We don't do that anymore.
No,
so,
it's a pity.
It's so funny. South Park did an episode where he walks into the television room and it's all dusty, and he starts running his hand down the TV because no one's watching TV anymore. His family used to gather and watch television. We used to complain about that. Yeah. All right, let me introduce our guest. First, it's Claudia Christian. She's best known for her work in the television series Babylon 5. Right, and we also have Dr. John Mendelsohn. Are you assistant associate clinical professor or
no,
full,
I'm a full
professor?
I'm a full professor.
Clinical professor of medicine at UCSF. We're going to talk about – he's the founder of Rhea Health. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Rhea Health.
Tell me about Rhea Health.
Rhea Health, well, I'm an internist. I've done a lot of work over the years funded by the NIH and NIDA and NIAAA. And Rhea Health, we use a technology platform and medications and breathalyzers and coaching to decrease people's drinking. And we've been live about a year now. We've treated a substantial number of patients. And we're showing about a 70% objective suppression of drinking as measured by breathalyzers and an increase in non-drinking days from about 1.5 to about 4 days per week in our patients.
Okay.
Right.
And Claudia, you have a story.
I've got a lot of stories, Drew.
Yes, we'll hear them. We've heard them.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably here because I advocate a treatment that I've been on since 2009 called the Sinclair Method, mm-hmm. which basically is very simple. You take a tablet of naltrexone an hour before you drink, and your drinking gradually diminishes. Your cravings, most importantly, go away. I was one of those people that, as much as I did the 12-step programs, AA in two different countries, 18 different meetings, traditional rehab, that sort of thing, psychotherapy, therapy, I had a consistent, as they say in AA, white knuckling or dry drunk. I was not a very happy sober person, as opposed to a lot of people.
Is that because of the irritability or the desire to use?
It was the craving and sort of the confusion as to how my brain changed and what happened when the compulsion crept in. I'm not a person who has other compulsive behaviors, so it was a complicated time for me. So I found that this treatment made obviously a massive difference in my life. It saved my life. And through the years, you just become disinterested in alcohol. It's not important anymore. It's not a focus, and most importantly to me, I don't think about it. And that was the most important thing, was when I was actively sober and participating in that. I was constantly thinking about it. So it was the compulsive thought pattern that I needed to eliminate in order to find my freedom. Everybody's recovery story is different.
Did you stay with the program also, or just not so much anymore?
With TSM?
No. I want to know if you stayed with that. I wonder if you've had other medical management. But are you still in a program of recovery of some type?
My recovery is the Sinclair method and helping other people. That's my recovery.
Does it come with therapy?
You can do it. This is the thing, is since, as we all know, every single individual is different. Mm-hmm. Some people definitely need CBT. Some people are drinking because of traumatic reasons. Some people are also real, just biological addicts.
Oh, yeah.
I deal with a lot of people that have a pressing need for privacy, airline pilots, police officers, lawyers, doctors. They seem to just want to, they want a harm reduction. They want to decrease their drinking because it's affecting their relationships or their profession in an adverse manner. A lot of people come to me with health issues. They're gaining weight because they're drinking too much wine. They're not as attentive with their children because of their drinking. But these are not people that you would say are chronic, physically dependent, alcohol dependent people. Mm-hmm. They suffer from a myriad of alcohol use disorders. So to answer your question, does every single person that comes to me and is successful with TSM use therapy? No, not every single one of them. It really has to be adapted per individual. It's not a magic pill. It's not good. You know what I mean? You have to, first of all, compliance is everything. You have to comply.
Why not use Vivitrol?
Anything anybody uses, I don't care if it's grapefruit or a shot.
Yeah.
You know, if it's a brownie that helped you, whatever helps you. From cannabis oil to whatever, I don't care. As long as you're better, I'm happy for you. Vivitrol, for me personally, I didn't want an opiate antagonist in my system 24/7 because the science behind targeted extinction made sense to me, to introduce the behavior you want to stop: gambling, porn addiction, alcohol drinking, to the opiate antagonist for that limited amount of time. I didn't want to wake up in the morning and work out, make love, eat spicy food, play with animals, and have that blocked.
Did you notice when you took the naltrexone?
That's important what she said.
Yeah, but listen, did you notice that it blocked all that when you took it?
I noticed that not with the targeted, but when I was, as an experiment, staying on naltrexone, even when I wasn't engaging in drinking alcohol, I did notice I didn't have the washout days. And TSM is a dual therapy. In other words, on your days that you don't drink and you don't take naltrexone, if you engage in good endorphin-producing activities, those activities become really great. I got addicted to Pilates. I have people who get addicted to wood carving. I mean addicted in the sense that it's not a bad addiction.
It becomes important.
It becomes an important. It's a replacement activity. So instead of the boredom of drinking or the excessive drinking, they start working out more, bodybuilding.
Try any other medical aids?
I didn't try any more medical aids.
Camprasate?
No, I didn't try Camprasate, Baclofen, Gabapentin. All of these came really after. I started this in 2009. So, I mean, I know they've been around forever, but I wasn't aware of them. When I went to traditional rehab, nobody told me about any medication. I did the research on my own.
Now, let's just debrief for people at home, because the four of us know what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're big advocates of naltrexone. But nobody seems to listen to us. They love Suboxone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know why. Doc, why is that?
Well, Suboxone is one of the drugs I helped develop, and I do know why, because opiate dependence is a different disease than alcohol dependence. But
opiate addicts, why is naltrexone not a popular replacement therapy?
Okay, it's not a replacement therapy, naltrexone, for opiate addiction. It's an antagonist therapy. So people actually
decrease cravings.
Not initially. It would be several months. Naltrexone and opiate dependence works primarily by blocking opiates when people use them. The naltrexone in Suboxone and the naloxone in Suboxone, and that was mostly my work that did this, doesn't actually interfere with the buprenorphine at all. It just makes it so that people abuse the Suboxone parenterally, meaning they inject it, right? Then they don't get as much of an effect, and they don't get any effect of other opioids.
Our biggest problem, they don't have to inject it because they're diverting it all over the place using it like crazy now. There's such a huge black market of Suboxone, we can't even stand it.
So our... our work, and this is a totally different conversation. We probably should have it at a different time.
Is that the
addition of naloxone, and I wrote most of the papers on this topic, so I'm still one of the leading experts in this area, is that we anticipated there would be diversion, but the diversion would not be parenteral. There would not be consequences
of
ejection.
No, I know, but we have massive diversion with this,
so you can't get everything. You can't get everything out of every. So
they don't need to be using a parenteral because using big doses.
Slow down a second. So that the big consequences of injection drug use are injection. Right, so Hep C, HIV, abscesses, endocarditis.
Our patients die of oral benzo. That's what kills them.
Yeah,
they don't die of injection drug.
You should invite me back down for a longer conversation about benzodiazepines. So my training is actually in clinical pharmacology, and actually I've published a lot in this territory. And the interaction of benzodiazepines and opiates is a complicated, poorly understood interaction. It doesn't appear to be pharmacokinetic, meaning it doesn't appear to be so that you take the two drugs together and you look at the blood levels of both of them. It does not appear that the blood levels predict the bad outcomes.
Right, right.
So what is predicting the bad outcome? And I understand you're an internist.
Yeah.
So it could be loss of airway. You get some suppression of airway control with the benzodiazepine and some vomiting with the opiate.
No, our guys don't vomit. They just stop breathing.
They stop. Okay. Well, in that case, we don't really understand.
It's just some synergistic effect on the chemoreceptor.
But why it doesn't occur earlier or consistently or repeatedly is really unknown. So it could also be you could have an acute PK change due to an interaction like a 3A4 inhibitor. But now we're going into the weeds of an area that doesn't have anything to do with alcohol abuse.
Right.
But it's usually
a slight bump. It's usually a moderately heavy oral opioid user who's using it, quote, as prescribed, who bumps the benzo a little bit.
Yeah,
and that's when they die.
So can I ask like how many deaths you've actually seen? I see a good joke in medicine that we always tell. So if I've seen something once in my entire career, I say it in my experience.
As a
physician, if I've seen something twice, I say in my series.
Yeah. How many?
And if I've seen three,
I know what you mean because the impact on us emotionally. Yeah. Bob, what would you say? How many patients do we have benzo opioid deaths?
Me, hundreds.
Yeah, I would say
hundreds.
I would say hundreds and hundreds.
Wow, that's my nephew.
And this is prescribed opiates mixed with.
Nowadays they're getting the illicit pills. But I mean, we're going down a rabbit hole, like you said.
Yeah.
The naloxone, I'm telling you, I always encourage people, right? And they report, once they connect and get to the other side of sobriety, one thing is I always say it takes 3 months to really detox.
Yeah.
So people think in terms of 14.
Sure. On a cellular level.
Yeah.
If they can make it that far, yes.
If they can make it 90 days and then they take the naltrexone and they report the same things that you as an alcoholic are reporting in opiate addicts are telling me, I notice a difference.
Mm-hmm. So,
but somehow our insurances don't cover it or it's just not as popular.
Because you have to get people to the other side you have to get them through the withdrawal phase, and that's the hard part.
You can taper on this though.
And some companies, there are people who do there's the Coleman procedure, and there's a.
Well, but here's what's crazy. We ran a program for 25 years.
Yeah.
Never once did we say to one another, "Oh my God, we got to do something with these heroin addicts in withdrawal. We can't get anybody through." We never had any trouble getting people off opiates. Never.
Uh-huh.
We used all the things at our disposal and used them, and everyone got off and everyone on their way. And we used them for months and months. We treat them.
Yeah.
But we never once said to ourselves, "Our big problem is getting the post-acute withdrawal syndrome under control or getting them off heroin." Ever.
Well,
it was never a problem.
There's certainly a prolonged post withdrawal. It was triggers and cravings, what we're talking about.
Triggers and cravings is what you were talking about with alcohol.
And even though
you're sober, it just won't go away.
And so Vivitrol has been promoted, and Vivitrol is now actively selling itself as an opiate a treatment for opiate dependence, and the uptake is still pretty slow compared to, you know, buprenorphine or methadone.
In regards to Vivitrol with alcohol, though, you're talking $1,200 a month as
$950. It came down since
my Screen Actors Guild insurance will give me 30 naltrexone for $10. So
okay, there
and you
go.
Only take it if you drink. So,
that is truth.
That's right.
Is what is affordable.
$10.
That's it. Done.
And Vivitrol is
just
primarily
made my decision.
Yeah.
And Vivitrol also doesn't. So one of the things that we've worked on that I worked on before we started RIA was medication adherence monitoring systems, and we built that into RIA as part of our system, so that we're quite interested in. We have people photograph the pill in their hand or tick a box for checking it.
And then you test what else they're taking, what other drugs they might be using?
We're not doing that. No, we're doing a telemedicine program.
Because that's our other problem. All our Suboxone patients are taking other substances.
Absolutely. And that's humans. You know, like, that's the world we live in, is that people take a lot of things and you have to...
Not when we go abstinence. They don't take anything. They do pretty darn well.
Well, you also can't take naltrexone if you're drinking and taking opiates, because you'll go into detox.
Opiate withdrawal.
Withdrawal.
Yeah.
You have to be...
But I love the idea. We used to use naltrexone a lot back in the day. And,
it's a really good
just
drug.
Just went out of favor.
It's a really good drug. Low-dose naltrexone, which is also another rabbit hole...
low-dose 25?
Low-dose, no, 0.5.
Whoa.
And 1 milligram is used for fibromyalgia, MS, neurological disorders, chronic pain, HIV, cancer. And this is so interesting to me, is I go to the LDN conventions every couple of years, and they do not, it's not FDA approved in low dose, but of course it's approved at 50 milligrams for alcohol use.
Yes.
So it's really a miracle. These opiate antagonists are miracle drugs, because if you uptake it, if you take it at night in very low dose, it'll hit that endorphin system when the human body creates the most endorphins about 3 o'clock in the morning or so. The next day, pain's gone, you feel terrific. Whereas if you take 50 milligrams in targeted extinction, of course you're blocking that compulsive behavior.
One milligram?
Point five.
How
one,
do you get
or
that?
One, well,
compounded
what I
do
will
compounded make it.
For my friends with fibromyalgia, I give them 150 milligram tablet.
That to me is fascinating.
They distill water.
I've always felt fibromyalgia was some kind of a sleep disturbance. The biology of sleep is off. I don't know what.
Yeah.
And take it at bedtime.
That to me is intriguing.
Between 1 milligram and 3 milligrams, and I'm telling you,
have you tried higher? Tried like 10?
I have one friend in England who's now up to about 7 milligrams, and she's gotten rid of her walker. She had actually
Why not just go right to 7 or 10?
Because you have to build up. It disrupts sleep sometimes, and it's called tirating.
Titrating.
Excuse me, I didn't want to say that wrong. Yeah, so she started at 0.5 and went up to about 7 milligrams. It's really phenomenal, I think, medication.
You know, within the addiction universe, the right dose of naltrexone is not well known. And I think some of the differences in the dose ranging that people need is due to bioavailability. That likely some people don't absorb as much as others, and or they clear it faster. And if you're willing to move the dose around, you can get a long way.
What did you take for your
I started right at 50 milligrams, but nowadays we tell people to start at 25 for four drinking sessions to get their body used to it. However, I have a lot of people on 75 to 100. It's safe up to 300 milligrams a day.
I never noticed people having much side effects from 50.
No, the only thing, the nausea is the number one side effect. And I always tell people, you got to eat before taking it, like any medication. You eat, drink water, let it come.
Some people feel
system.
Really fatigued and weird.
Usually when they're on other meds, though, right? That's when I've seen that.
If you're super clean, I started it when I was 4 months sober, and I felt it in my system, definitely.
So we could probably answer that question. I haven't answered that systematically at this point. We built a system where people can actually track. We can track their medicines. We can track what time they're taking them and which ones. And we can track their blood alcohol concentrations and after episodes of drinking. That's how we know to adjust the naltrexone dose. We're using a quantitative approach that's really similar to what people would do for high blood pressure or diabetes. And that's, I think, one of the big missing pieces in addiction care is that you say, let's get to abstinence, but you don't have any intermediate marker points that you let people get to or quantify. And if you don't do that, most people are not going to get to excellent blood pressure control on one medication. And if you don't measure it, you won't know, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to have a way to count. And the mechanisms of counting have been what
always been the problem.
It totally. And we built a couple of those in the research world, and we're now putting those into the we don't use the SCRAM system, the transcutaneous alcohol.
How do you do it?
Well, again, we have people breathalyze frequently. The breathalyzer is paired with a smartphone. The data comes right to
that
we have an app. The app notifies you when you should be breathalyzing, mm-hmm. and then we get a reading around that time, and then they
That's
you know
smart.
We follow that.
It helps
that.
With accountability and adherence.
Exactly. And you can see therapeutic response, right? Or not. Right. If you're not getting a response, you can do something different. You can up the dose. You can change the meds. You can add more counseling or more therapy. You can do whatever you need to do.
I'm sure it's working. I'm sure. Yeah. I'm open-minded about whatever will work. Yeah. My heart of hearts is in what will work for the masses. You have 17 million opiate addicts that just appeared out of thin air thanks to Purdue Pharmaceuticals.
We actually had them before. The
potential for them.
We were talking
there.
About fentanyl earlier, John and I. That's even scarier.
No, you know, 1 in 20 Iranians. 1 in 20 Iranians is 5% of the population. In the United States, we had about 5% of the population being opiate dependent around 1900, and that led to the Harrison narcotic. You know,
now it's exploded.
The number's gone back up, and you know, it's heading maybe towards its natural level. I think it dropped considerably for a while. Before that lulled physicians into thinking they could treat pain more. There'd be better management with better opioids. I think what you're seeing is a natural cycles of addiction, and you know, like over time, no one ever wants the drug their older brother took. You know,
that we're seeing.
Yeah, exactly.
12, 13, 14 year olds.
90% of the opiates on earth are prescribed in our country.
That's not a true statement. I'm going to dispute that statement. I'm going to fight you a little on that one, because I think the prescribed is the key word. So most Afghan opiate production ends up in either Russia or Iran. Okay.
There may be opium users and opium addicts.
In Iran, there is for sure. I know firsthand
prescribed.
There is.
Now, that's on a background. That's on a background that some countries don't still allow opiate prescribing for even surgical pain, right? So prescribing is the key word there. And you need to – if you disentangle that
– Well, no. If they allow opium prescribing for surgical pain – that means our pharmaceutical prescribing is even a higher percentage of the pills being produced in the world. So it's worse than – you're making it worse than I was saying.
But again, I think if you actually look at the numbers, you go back and you
80% of the prescribing on earth is because we lived through the
– 70,000 kids dying last year is not a mirage. That's never happened before.
No, that's correct.
We lived through the thing that happened because all we did was treat chronic pain patients.
Exactly.
We got them off opiates. That's all we did.
Yeah.
They had no – they would come in without exception. Every single case, and we – again, hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of these guys.
Workers' comp.
Yeah,
exactly.
They're all workers' comp. They all were overprescribed. There's no evidence that the pain was being made worse.
Exactly.
They made better. They all came in and said, how's your pain on a scale of 10?
Exactly.
15, 20.
And they're talking and they're talking on their cell phone while they have a 20 pain.
We took them off opiates. Yep. 2 weeks later, they would not mention their pain unless prompted.
Exactly.
And they would always say 5 or 6.
So what explains that?
We did that just thousands of times.
Well,
and then they would be tap dancing for us and go do be fine, be great, great. And then they're drug addicts, and then they'd get back into their workers' comp system.
Exactly.
And then they would die.
Exactly. And I think the explanation for that particular epidemic is multifocal. And so some people, you know, many, many people with hard physical jobs get injured. And to stay working, like a few Norcos, makes it much easier to, you know, pound the nails.
100% of them had severe childhood trauma.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
That was completely ignored and overlooked.
Yeah.
No one asked the question when they came in with their back pain.
So it's interesting. We're actually asking that, and we take a pretty detailed history for our RIA patients. And, you know, I don't you know,
alcohol is not that high.
Yeah, exactly. Alcohol's, I was going to say, it's surprising. It's I have not, you know, abuse, neglect, trauma. I'd say maybe 15 or 20%.
You're saying for opiate addicts, so
for opiates, it's very high. Yeah, well, particularly the chronic pain patient was 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to ask specific questions. You have to say, yeah. Did anybody ever pick up an object and hit you?
Yeah.
Did you have to ask it like that? Because otherwise, they will not tell you there was physical abuse.
Yeah, interesting.
You have to ask very specific questions. You have to. Did anybody ever touch you when you were a child in places that you felt were uncomfortable?
Uh-huh.
You have to ask highly targeted, or they will go, "No, I'm fine. I was disciplined like anybody else. I got whatever." You know, he goes, "Discipline."
Yeah, we had a tough family.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
We had a tough
family.
Everybody's been slapped around.
Exactly.
And you have to ask high. And then when you really start to get into it. I mean, literally, I have routine questions. I go, "Oh yeah, mom would pick up a bat once in a while. Yeah, there's a knife. Yeah, oh, routinely.
Your mom too, right?
Routinely, right. Yeah." And I would go, "No, I'm not sure every family."
So she's still picking the knife up. Is she still picking a knife up?
My mom used words.
The workers' comp was a thing that we had that we could study in our way. But the thing
fascinating.
The thing that's interesting to me is. I became a heroin addict in 1985. I went back and looked at the disease control statistics and 3,800 opioid overdose deaths in 1985.
Yeah.
67,000 in 2016.
Yeah.
There's a trend that's going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So one thing people don't talk about with all those overdose deaths too is that we now have the ability to actually measure the opiates in blood. So back in 1975, we actually did not have technology that allowed you to discriminate most of the opiates that people are dying of. Okay? So there is a measurement issue here. And the measurement issue is with LC tandem mass spectroscopy. We can now do a complete screen, drug screen panel in one sample of blood. I've heard this argument before.
So in 1985, the Norco or the Percocet overdose, like say Elvis Presley, right?
Yeah.
He's categorized as what then? As a death, not an overdose death?
No, he might still be categorized as an overdose death, but you had to look, you had to go back. I mean, medical examiners can now, with a single blood test, screen for over 150 drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So when Elvis died, they had to request each one individually, and it was a major lab workup. So this is a big change in technology. I don't think all you can explain, you know, maybe 10 or 20% of the increased numbers in better technology to detect drugs.
Okay.
But And when you actually sort of drill down on anyone in terms of drug use, they're often using an incredible array of substances, right?
Isn't this also an accessibility question? I mean, who had access to fentanyl in 1985?
Yeah.
Or you know, massive amounts.
I probably could have if I really researched it.
And the guy, you probably could.
By the way, Bob was a buprenorphine addict.
Yeah, did you know Dr. Howard Mark?
No.
He was here in Los Angeles.
No.
He believed in buprenorphine.
Yeah.
In the 80s.
People are getting hooked on that, aren't they?
Right?
Oh, yeah.
What?
Well, he was an addict.
I used it intramuscularly. He was.
Yeah, okay.
And
so you're
shut in your stomach, and you hold your stomach out, and you would have no
interesting.
No withdrawal. You know, if you were strung out and you needed to travel, for instance.
Yeah.
This is before the tsunami of opioids all across the country. If you traveled, there was only heroin in San Francisco,
Amsterdam.
Seattle, Portland, Chicago, sometimes Denver.
So you know,
if you had to travel, I was in a band, it would hold you over until you got there. But I also noticed that I was cool with it as long as I didn't have access to heroin.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I wasn't sitting there like you, the white knuckling, mm-hmm. can't wait to get to Denver. Yeah. I was just cool,
so
I was drinking.
You were drinking, exactly.
And that'll help.
But in L.A., if I was drinking, I would still always at night go get drugs.
In methadone clinics, roughly 10 to 15% of the patients aren't dosed every day because they're drinking heavily. They're blowing greater than 08. So,
I think I couldn't have had a drink in 12 hours and I would blow 08.
And so the combination of alcohol and opiates and that interaction is very interesting and one which we don't have a good handle on right now. And that's,
I thought you
that's,
got more strung out on buprenorphine, no?
Well, what do you mean by strung out? You
well,
mean
he, have a, he, the,
well
he
no, then about 2 years later, a friend of mine, I was always scared. Yeah. I wasn't a doctor. I grew up in a medical family, so doctors are like gods. You do what
good,
they
good,
say.
Good. I like, I hear,
my
that's
doctor
good. That's excellent.
Told
that's
me, a, Dr. You, Howard Mark told me, shoot it in your mouth. Yeah. Then our buddy Scott, who's passed away, tells me you don't have to. You can put it in a spoon and put Coke in it and shoot it. And I watched him do it, and that's when I got what Dr. Drew has called hooked on it.
So a I don't think anyone's advocating a combination formulation of buprenorphine and cocaine for the treatment of anything.
All of this is
the person in all.
I was just talking about wine.
but
I'm telling you now. Trexone works for both. I know that it does. I've seen opiate addicts.
It's just hard to get
Renee,
them on.
Renee, my friend, the naltrexone implant. Kaiser, 15 years ago, really believed in the naltrexone implant for opiate addicts. It worked. It was the first time I ever seen him happy.
You know, it's an interesting. You could make a very interesting argument about the. If you wanted to push that a little bit, that patients who were both combination alcohol addicts and opiate addicts should be best treated with naltrexone. And that would actually be a very interesting – be an interesting therapeutic argument to make and to push on. And you know, that would actually be a worthwhile – if you guys have patients, that would be a worthwhile trial to actually – to actually
so
work
let's
out.
Get
there is you know Vivitrol has many disadvantages and
the money
and
is
prices
the,
prices
the price
up,
is the big disadvantage.
Make it the 4 mL big injection you
why
know,
do some insurances like, pay like, for it and some don't
I mean I think well
it's the same thing as why do some insurances you know cover
yeah if anyone
any
could
form of treatment yeah. telemedicine well that's another telemedicine is what over 92% of the US is covered by telemedicine at this point and yet some's not covered by insurance
so the way you have to go through you always want to blame the insurance companies, and we're in the process right now of with RIA of going through the vetting process and the proof the evidence process for an insurer, and they have a pathway for this, and you have to follow their pathway, and the path that they need sufficient published data, mm-hmm. they need evidence that the way you deliver the treatment is safe, reproducible, they have a process, and if you follow that process, you'll get your treatment approved. So it's likely that until when Alkermes first came out with Vivitrol for alcohol abuse, and that was David Gastrond who pushed that forward, mostly a physician, a psychiatrist at Harvard.
The data was awfully good.
The data was good, but they never pushed it. They never sought an indication for opiate dependence, nor did they discuss that with insurance companies.
Right.
So now
that was weird.
So now
wait though, I'm just thinking as a criminal. So my friend could say he's an alcoholic, maybe, and get it correct.
Yeah, if his insurance covers it.
Yeah. Well, if you had the exactly
but the implant would be difficult.
Why do we have to out-trick our medical system?
But you have to go.
I have people who cannot get naltrexone. Nobody's ever overdosed from naltrexone.
Yes.
It's non-addictive. It is an opiate blocker, yet their doctor refuses to prescribe it, especially off-label, like i.e., you know, taking it before you drink. But if the patient comes in and says, I have enormous cravings for alcohol, naltrexone, that's what it's proven to help in clinical trials, and the doctor will refuse them this potentially life-saving medication.
Exactly.
This subset of patients that have these huge cravings and stuff, if you remember these guys, we would see them once in a while early in treatment too, and they're hard to keep in treatment because they're crazed by the preoccupation. Acamprosate sometimes really works for that.
I have heard that. I haven't taken it personally, but I also know that for some people who...
About 30% of the time, I'd say.
I don't think they had naltrexone at Los Angeles, did they?
No, I used to use it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I've never used it like this, though.
Acamprosate a lot of people who don't have the tolerance for, especially nalmefene, which is what they use in the UK and in Europe for alcohol use disorder, has side effects that certain people simply cannot endure.
Well, and you can get this horrible muscle cramps.
Muscle cramps, flu-like symptoms.
I've only saw that a couple times, but it was bad.
And I think that's, you know, like polypharmacy is completely underutilized in addiction space. And camprosate I think the real story with pharmacotherapy in alcohol addiction is that we have a bunch of weak players They all work to some degree. Mm-hmm. None of them are silver bullets. And when you have a bunch of drugs that naltrexone's the best. Naltrexone's absolutely the best one, right? That, you know, like you can get a good response out of if the patients tolerate naltrexone and are motivated and have the right supports, you get a good response in naltrexone at least half the patients.
25 years later in Finland, they've been using it as the number one form of treatment.
How long have you been on it?
Since 2009.
Did you still take it once in a while?
Once in a while, yeah, once in a blue moon. But in Finland, they've been using it since the 90s. It was actually funded by an act of parliament there. They still have a 78% long-term success rate. That's three out of four patients successfully treated that way. So it's if it's done correctly, but once again, you put in human fallibility, non-compliance, this kind of thing. Yeah. Oh, I don't want to wait the hour. Nothing is perfect, as you said.
And studies here show a lower response rate, but still, important. And we're certainly showing a pretty good response rate with it. And I think the question is how do you what are the best ways to combine things? What are the best ways to motivate patients? And what are the best ways to get the treatments out there and used? I think from our side of the story, I totally agree that naltrexone can induce a very nice response in a very substantial number of patients, but you still need to have some way to measure what they're drinking. So one of the things we wrestle with patients on is that they say, "Oh, doc, they're blowing 0.2 when they first come in, but breathalyzed 0.2 at the end of a drinking evening, and we bring them down to 0.1 in 3 weeks." They say it's not working,
So you go,
what do you mean it's not working, man? You're drinking half the amount of alcohol you used to drink, and your BAC is now almost at the legal limit, which is still massively too high. But it's not, we need to give you more, not less. But that's partly the disease is sneaky disease. The disease is sneaky
People
disease.
People want an overnight success, yeah.
No, they also, the disease doesn't want to go away. The disease likes to stick around, right?
So how long do you think it sticks around for? Because I have my thoughts about it.
Well,
okay. I believe that if you can make the 5-year point, you're pretty clear sailing.
Yeah. That's why I never encourage anybody with long-term sobriety to try.
But we never tell them that in the first month,
so
that this is going to be a 5-year process.
Or even
then they'll get bummed out and go drink.
Yeah, or even a one. So there is precious little data on recovery.
Yeah.
Precious little data on recovery.
Recovery meaning what?
Like the temporal pattern of recovery, the persistence.
What do you mean by recovery? What does that mean?
It's a consistent thought pattern.
No. I'm talking about if you look at National Survey of Drug Use and Health data, or NARSDAC data, stuff from the ARG and Berkeley, in terms of incidence and prevalence of drinking. Right. We know that amongst people who've had a drinking problem, right, there's a peak and it tends to decline over time. Right. So we don't know anything about that process of, if you have asthma at age 20, right, I can give you some prediction of how much asthma you're likely to have at 30, 40, 50, and 60. Okay. Mm-hmm. Could be the same, could be a little less. If you have obesity at age 20, I can tell you what your weight's going to look like at 30, 40, 50, 60. If you have alcohol addiction at age 20, I can't tell you what your addiction is going to look like by numbers, right, at 30, 40. But I sort of can, because actually, if you look at the peak incidence of binge drinking in the United States,
college.
It happens in 26, post-college, 26 years old, and it declines every year after that. Okay,
that's binge drink. That's binge use.
Well, but binge drinking is actually very well connected with alcohol use disorder.
Right, and but there's a subset of binge drinkers.
But still, the decline in numbers of binge drinkers. So it's really interesting. So I don't think I totally agree with you that if you make it to 5 years in almost anything, you're probably okay. Mm-hmm. But like with breast cancer, we can tell someone you made 5 years, you're cured. Right, so we need that for addiction. We need it for addiction. And one of the things that I think makes it difficult.
John Kelly out of Harvard has data that shows at 5 years, if you can takes on average four treatments to make it 5 years.
Exactly.
Four treatment to get 1 year of treatment. And if you make it 5 years of abstinence, your risk ratio goes back to normal, to the same as the average population.
And then some of those people resume drinking, and they don't resume harmful drinking, which is amazing.
And some of those people resume drinking, binge, and die.
Exactly.
It's not something you want to play around with.
This is an absolutely fascinating area, and I think we need to have we ought to have better risk stratification for people over time, and that would be really useful. You know, that would be really a useful kind
I've
of,
found that people and, on TSM take anywhere from 3 months to some people have to up their dose and go 9 to 12 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some doctors say, think,
nine
you know.
9 to 12 months for what? To do what?
Nine to 12 months to reach what we call extinction, which is you no longer think. Yeah. Alcohol is like, meh. Yeah. I could take it or leave it. You know, and then they plan their, if they go to a New Year's Eve party or something, they'll say, well, you know what, tonight
Who
I'll take
Who helps
a pill.
With that planning? That's what I, because I believe we are a broken society, and that's why all this is happening.
That's why.
So attachment, community, you know.
So important.
It's so important. Mm-hmm. So to say, and I have, you know, I talk with my friends. They talk with me. I'm going to visit my mother. I'm going to be there for 2 days.
It's a trigger. yeah. You know what I mean? Can I call you?
But I just think that part of the rise in addiction in America is the lack of community.
Fellowship and community.
Yes.
Absolutely. And that's why I say, why can't you combine? I always encourage people, if they if they like AA or Smart Recovery, there's no your only obligation is the desire to quit drinking.
So I'm talking about just talking to your neighbors.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's you know what I mean? But it's broken down.
But that's also shame and stigma. When somebody calls you a drunk or weak or lazy or disgusting, you're not exactly going to turn to that person and say, you know what, I'd like to talk to you about
triggers. No, you move
triggers.
To a new neighborhood and make new friends.
You're bringing up a really interesting thing, though, with those words you were using, because we reserve a special disdain for women that drink. Women eat it, take it. They know they take it more than
our
anybody.
Society.
Oh, yeah. Women.
Our
women. Society. Oh, it's
not you guys personally.
Not us. We don't personally.
No. I was going to say, what the hell?
Thank you very much. We'll be back
some other time.
We got zero, but the world used these words.
Oh, these. You know what? Some. I never forget this, but one of my biggest triggers was there was a relative of mine that used to say, "You're so ugly when you're so bloated. You look so ugly." And these words were such triggers.
They don't
triggers.
Say that to men.
No, never.
No,
that's
did they
the
say,
point.
You look bloated?
Yeah.
Have you been drinking?
You never say
to a guy,
hey, you're out of control, dude. You go,
you're wasted, man.
You're working pretty hard these days.
Exactly. But a woman is sloppy or disgusting. All of these words, it's, oh, she was wasted.
So that's great. So we should stigmatize men more.
Well, no.
Maybe I'm missing the point of the conversation.
It's the meanness of our society.
Well, no, I would argue that I think you hit the word, which was disgusting. All those words imply disgusting.
And I have to say something, and I made this point today in social media. I don't usually engage on social media, but somebody referred, they were trying to give a compliment to somebody who had achieved 3 years of complying on TSM and had alcohol meant nothing to them anymore, and they came out, so to speak.
Right.
That day they said, I haven't talked about this because I thought it would hurt my business, but I want you to know I've been on TSM for this long. And one of their in-laws chimed in and said, oh, I'm so glad because, you know, most of my family are a bunch of drunks. And I just interjected and I said, you know, that's just not a healthy term. It's just not something that if you're going to be on board with somebody in recovery on any stage of their recovery, let's start. Would you call somebody that's bipolar crazy, bonkers, you know, what, you don't use those words anymore. We're more respectful, and I think mental illness is a great
still
pattern to. No, it's come a long way, and now we have to treat addiction in the same manner. You know, all of these lazy, immoral, and all this junk is so antiquated, and we really need to start getting rid of those. And oh, there's semantics, but it's something that's.
And I don't
important.
Know how we do in a society that's so divided and so broken. Well, live in Valhalla.
More
you
of
live
us
in San Francisco.
You know what?
Exactly.
You know, Bob, but more of us have to come out and be honest about
that's
our stories.
That's what I was going
to
say.
And I think it was one of the most liberating things in the world. I wrote a book about it, made a film about it. And you know what? The second you come out of the closet and you say, yeah, I had this problem, thousands of people come to you and say, oh, so do I.
Well, exactly. Listen, me too. Yeah. That's why I think Me Too needs to be spread out
Me
across
Too
a
is,
lot
well,
of other things.
You know what? One of the I did a TED Talk, and I tell that's, you, that reached more people than anything because people, the second they Google, you know, alcohol, bam, it comes up, and they go and they identify with that person who's talking to you. And I think the less shame and stigma, but you know this, I'm just preaching to the choir.
I have a whole thing about stigma, I've got to give a talk on that soon, and I'm trying to figure out how to frame it, actually. You know anybody good
without looking like an authoritarian.
Right. No, it's that there's not – it's all very loosey-goosey.
No, I think actually
I think we should start calling people out for these names. Like I do it every time. I don't like
well,
that
but
vernacular.
I think addict –
I have a hard time with that.
Drunk is different than addict.
Clean and dirty.
I say compulsive behavior.
Clean and dirty. Try to get away from clean and dirty. Try to get away from, you know, like
the thing I'm doing is more towards mental health, not just addiction, but the stigmas around stuff. And
But it's changed for the better. I have so many
people
in these communities saying, "Yeah, I'm bipolar. Hey, I'm."
It has to come from within.
Yes,
so for years, I identified as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was my occupation. Then you are that. We do this in America. Whatever our occupation is who we are. Then I became a drug addict.
Yeah.
And that rehab world and the 12-step world reinforces labeling yourself this addict, right? Which I didn't have a problem with. But over the years, and especially the last 5 or 6 or 7, I most identify with the term father or parent.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to allow ourselves to have these organic, natural acknowledge rather than say, no, I'm a drug addict. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to identify. I'm a musician. There's labels that identifications.
I think words are very strong, too.
But I think in all this conversation belies a phenomenon. It's called self-stigmatizing,
mm-hmm.
which I think is more present than we realize. And, and people externalize that as the world stigmatizing me. But I think the self-stigma, lack of self-efficacy, feelings of self, whatever, you know, broken, that's, I think, where the real powerful stuff is that people are not really talking about right now.
Well, I also, every time somebody would debate the disease model, Dr. Sinclair himself always called this a learned behavior, which is a much gentler way of discussing alcoholism. But the only thing I said about a disease is, okay, it is progressive and it can kill me. And I felt more comfortable in that as opposed to standing up every day and saying, I'm in this disease. I don't want to be in it. I want to get through it. I want to get through the other side and look back and say, wow, that was really a crappy, nearly decade-long battle to fix it, much like cancer or any other thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't like to play the semantics word, but so much of that is attached to stigma. You know, standing up and saying, I'm an addict, I'm an addict, I'm an addict every day. And a lot of people can't, that triggers them. That's just, you know, it's more labeling.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it is yourself. If you say, now I'm an advocate or now I'm a father.
Because in the recovering community, words like addict and junkie are dealt with playfully. They're defanged. You know, you used to call yourself a junkie all the time. Now you've been a little more.
I know.
When I call you junkie these days, you get a little
like
more dicey about it.
I don't like it.
I'm playful with wino, but I don't like the sloppy or disgusting
disgusting
is ugly.
Here's another thing. Here's another thing that happened with my group of people that terminology we accepted it because we had a bunch of musicians who got sober, probably at the highest rate of any occupation in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I would agree.
And we were so connected to each other that calling ourselves drug addicts really wasn't a negative. But then I started having different types of experiences. Doctors, for some reason, we had the doctor's diversion program at our hospital, and they loved me, and they would ask me to sponsor them or sit down for coffee. And so they didn't like the term. And I know.
No kidding.
It evolved my thinking about it. Not everybody likes the term alcoholic.
If you prefaced it with doctor, they'd be happier.
Doctor junkie?
Alcoholic MD, I think. Doctor junkie, I think, right? Professor.
My only concern, though, was that I always felt they should not have any more emotion attached to it than if we called them asthmatic.
Well, here's what we should ask. We're trying to see this evolution in Suboxone. He was just a part of the opioid conference with Trump.
Yeah.
And it looks like Suboxone is going to be a major player in Medicaid, right?
Yes.
Doctors can't be on Suboxone and practice medicine. Why is that? That's always our question.
That's always been our thing.
It's a weird thing, right?
Doctors can't.
We don't prescribe it to ourselves ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's good data, and I've just pulled some data where they say no.
It's still verboten by the medical boards, as well as having an alcohol problem, as well as being treated for it. It's complicated around whether we can whether we can treat or not. I think. For opiates, the DEA is concerned about who has access to the prescription pad, and what people might do, either to sell or divert their
medication. They have the highest success rate
of recovery. The doctor's diversion program is the most successful drug program in America.
And one of the best places, for some of the physicians, like if the physicians are in outpatient medicine where they have no access to drugs, I don't think there's a big issue. But my wife's an anesthesiologist.
We sent them back to anesthesia. Our patients were anesthesiologists and cardiologists.
Yeah, I think anesthesia.
And we had how high? 90%?
Yeah.
In the 80s, it was quantifiable and documented that doctors' diversion is the most successful.
And they're not using Suboxone.
So then they don't.
Absolutely no Suboxone.
No,
so
I think,
well, then why aren't they using that as a
I gave them naltrexone.
I
gave them naltrexone because I was worried about them using while they were on
the job. So why don't they use that as a study?
So I think...
Well, it's very punitive, actually. It's very brutal.
The doctor's diversion system is extremely brutal.
Not as bad as nursing.
And the medical board gets extra points for taking licenses away.
No. I worked with those guys very closely.
They hold them in good stead.
They would hold them over their heads.
Yeah, that sort of gamma.
But that's what got the motivation to get them into treatment.
That's what I think, exactly.
Yeah, and I've had a few docs come in. It's for my opiate practice and for the alcohol
practice. I know three who've lost their licenses.
Yeah. But if you're going to ask the question whether physicians should lose their access to their careers over drugs, then you got to ask the question whether everyone should.
Well, airline pilots should.
Yeah, exactly.
Doctors should. Yeah. Bus drivers. Let me tell my story from my first drug treatment.
Drew,
oh, no, I've worked with United Airlines.
Before we go, let me tell my first drug treatment. You could be taking a liability you're
so, not aware so of.
I was in my first drug treatment in 1988 or 89. I can't remember.
I'm just running a nonprofit.
And it was at a time when Northwest Airlines pilots were arrested off the plane.
I remember that.
I was in rehab with those guys. And everyone in the group, in 12-step Hazelden, right? 12-step. Really like, it's really fucked up what you did to the pilots, And I'm thinking, like, I'm a musician. Who could I hurt?
With a drumstick.
And so there was this, it got very confrontational because the idea that they were flying drunk.
Name calling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there was all this animus towards them. This old little dude. Like, he looked like 75 years old, but he was like an alcoholic. He was probably 60, right? And he just said, boy, y'all don't want to know what I do for a living.
Is he a surgeon?
No.
Brain surgeon.
He was a train conductor the railroad that took the nuclear waste through the East.
Exactly.
And I think everybody just went, that's even worse than a pilot.
It's even worse. Yeah, blow up a whole city.
So what you're bringing up is another area we actually are working on in our academic side, which is impairment measurement.
And
you really want to know who's impaired at a particular moment in time. Do we really? I think you want to know for yourself.
Brain surgeon, definitely.
And even musician about whether you're going to go on stage. A big problem we're having now is drug driving in elderly patients, right?
Drug driving.
People prescribe Benadryl. people prescribe Benadryls over the counter.
Yes, or a late night benzo, a half milligram of clonopin.
No, I think we're just talking. We're talking, you know, nortriptyline. We're talking, basically, there's an issue about whether when people should drive and they shouldn't drive, and prescription medications that aren't considered, you know, like habit forming or abusable, can impair people's driving. In fact, there's a great group out of Holland that you guys should talk to, where they actually have them. They built special cars that have the two steering wheels and the two sets of brakes, and they have like a camera that goes over the side of the car and stares down at the little lane divider. Mm. And they have people they give people medications, and then they have them drive, and they can demonstrate driving impairment. They measure the deviation for the center line. They're told to drive. They have a course on the road. Right? It's absolutely fantastic work.
Wow. And a couple quick emails, everybody. 48-year-old disabled veteran living in New York City prescribed Klonopin and Oxy for depression.
Mm. Okay.
OxyContin for depression?
Even I know work. That's nuts.
And then goes, it'll work, though.
And pain. Uh-huh. And I'm addicted to both. I admitted myself to VA hospital twice. All they offer is a two-week program at Suboxone. I need help. He's not making it. She's not working. It's Tamara.
It depends on how long she's – because there's some weird thing where they move over to TRICARE after the first 2 years out of the service.
I will just tell you the big problem –
TRICARE offers alternative treatments and everything.
I talked to Dr. Sulkin, and I said, look, you're not giving any sort of handoff. You need some sort of warm handoff, a warm shake, to get somebody involved in other connected organizations or groups. The VA is this huge monstrosity. You're trying to mill them through. You've got to have some – you've talked about coaching groups or some personal sort of connection to keep them coming back and connected.
Well, I think I'd want to know in this email what they mean by not making it. Are they using opiates? Are they drinking?
Yeah. Oxycontin and Klonopin.
But still, I mean, she's still using Oxycontin and Klonopin.
That would make you more depressed.
Well, I don't understand why that combination. I know why they end up on that combination, because they always are in chronic withdrawal and they can't sleep and they have back pain and somebody puts a benzo on.
Yeah, and once they go on, it's impossible to get. It's very difficult.
So much study being done with cannabis for post-traumatic stress disorder, but the VA is, which is phenomenal results. And the VA is like,
hey. Ibogaine and Hiawatha,
you know, and we were talking earlier that, you know, it takes
MDMA.
I have an IND for LSD. I'm
10
one of the few
to 20
people
years
in the world who actually has
from research
who
to practice.
Does that,
are you doing research with it?
No,
that's
we're not anymore.
Delayed.
Why not?
Yeah. Well, we ran out of funding frankly,
I'm doing a documentary on hallucinogens. I may need to interview you for that.
Yeah, you may come up and talk to some of our people. I was the PI.
Because I don't understand why it's not being investigated more.
Well,
this is a whole other topic, but it's fascinating.
Let's get into ayahuasca,
please.
MDMA.
Sorry, but I got to know.
So that was so my lab. We actually did several NIH funded studies with MDMA.
Well, that's for PTSD. But what about the hallucinogens per se?
Well, we were interested in those. So Roland Griffiths at Hopkins is the guy you really want to talk to.
Roland Griffiths, and is for end of life stuff, or is it for PTSD?
No. Roland is actually interested in how spiritual things actually happen. He's interested in the mechanisms of.
Isn't everybody
exactly?
Why do you think we drank?
Roland, exactly.
Came damn close to spiritual.
Griffiths, Roland Griffiths.
But there's the UCLA was doing a whole thing on end of life too.
Yeah, that was Charlie Grobe. And Charlie is not. But I thought Charlie was being a little disingenuous. He's interested in end of life, but also they were also making the pitch that people wouldn't be as messed up if they were end of life patients. That couldn't do as much harm.
True. I mean, that's true.
I don't think that's the case. I think if you're harmed, you're harmed, and I think you're not willing to push your medications into people at younger age points. You shouldn't be willing to give them to people who are dying either.
But I don't personally. I relate because I thought if I were dying, I'd be willing to take that risk.
So most people plus death death is now a very different thing than
what
it was.
In what sense?
Oh, just because medical therapy exactly.
That's the end of life.
Exactly.
I don't want to label you, but most people that think like me have that plan that you just mimicked like.
What we're telling you is, no one else sees patients dies except internists and oncologists.
Exactly.
And they send them all to us to die. Exactly. Always. And we just deal with it. And for me, having improved end of life sort of options to me sounds very appealing.
Yeah. So the problem is that if you're doing really well with what other end of life options you have,
I mean opiates
or. Stimulants benzos. In some cases to keep your energy level up. In some cases, just assistive devices.
Yeah.
OxyContin was a good drug for that.
If you're dying in pain. Yeah.
And
how about when you're 20 and just bummed out?
And if you look like heart failure, so congestive heart failure is a common mechanism of death for people and they either have long-standing high blood pressure, they've had heart attacks, they have something called diastolic dysfunction. Right, we can maintain them without much dyspnea for a very long period of time.
Yes,
but when they finally deteriorate, the deterioration is usually rapid, like a week or two before death intervenes.
Yeah.
So why would you spend a day getting intoxicated on LSD if you're really doing well for like 9 months before?
I agree with that.
That's been the real challenge.
Just getting a heart failure patient to understand they have a limited life expectancy is very, very difficult. A cancer patient kind of gets that. I'm really thinking of cancer patients.
Even when you tell that patient, they hear the biggest number. You tell them survival is any place from 1 to 5 years. I'll be here in 5 years, doc. Don't worry.
I get you.
But
it's also if your pain is that overwhelming. I've had friends who passed from incredibly painful cancer, and yes, they took the morphine, OxyContin.
For a lot of people, it's more the functional decline over time that they don't have the energy to get up and do things. They have like an hour or 2 a day. Exactly, hearts are bad things. It's not fear of death, then. It's just can't accomplish a lot.
Lack of productivity.
A lot of productivity.
All right, guys, we've got to wrap this thing up. It has been a privilge and a pleasure. Awesome. Claudia Christian, is there a website you want to refer people to?
C3 Foundation. C3Foundation.org. We
need to put that on the website.
C3Foundation.org.
And Dr. Mendelsohn?
Rhea Health, R-I-A health.com.
And describe again who should be checking you guys out.
Anyone who wants to cut their drinking down or stop it.
Alcohol use disorder is really we're
completely focused. We're building a vertical system that treats that.
Before I wrap, there was a group down here, Dr. Jaffe, doing moderation. Management and stuff. Is this the new incarnation of that to some extent?
Yes and no. I think where we fit that really no one has gone before is this area of quantifying your behaviors making therapeutic decisions based on quantification and on support. We're focused on keeping people moving forward, and that's what that's the machine we built.
Great,
awesome,
Bob. Anything
all
else?
All right. Just I got to get home. The kids are waiting for me.
How old?
It's 2 and 7.
2 and 7.
You live? And did 20, Susie, you made
18 and 21. So,
all right. We'll see you next time.
Yep. All right, see ya.
Out the door.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at drdrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.